Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Mike Thompson, 33592, and I represent the appellants in this matter, Randy and Mary Nicole Loveland and their 9-year-old daughter, Alexa. At the start here, I want to note that I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. As noted in the record, the Loveland's 9-year-old daughter was injured on a zip line at a Black Rock Elementary School in St. Vrain Valley School District on November 21st, 2008. She fell off the zip line and had a compound fracture in her left wrist as a result. It was the third such incident that had occurred at the elementary school since the beginning of that school year, and that was the first year that the zip line was in existence on the school playground there. We are here today because the trial court, from our vantage point, did not broadly construe the term public facility in reviewing the defendant's motion to dismiss. And as a result, granted that motion to dismiss. We are asking this court to reverse that decision and remand us back for a hearing so that we can have a hearing on the dangerous condition issue in this case, which I think is an issue with contested facts. Importantly, though, as we talked about in the brief, there is a little bit of dispute about how the trial court went about its ruling, and I think it's clear that the trial court did not make any findings of fact besides the one that is there was no dispute that kept it from dismissing the case over this public facility term. I think it's clear that the trial court did not view the facts in a light most favorable to plaintiff. I think the court never even got to the dangerous condition issues in which it would be doing so. And that's critical because if you recognize that, it's clear to me anyways that we have to have a hearing in this case to deal with those issues. On the public facility issue, which it used to make its ruling, the trial court simply said, this is a zip line, I see a picture of it. Neither party is disputing that that's the zip line. I don't think that's a public facility, and dismissed the case.
Mr. Thompson, I want to make sure I'm understanding the framework here, because the briefs confuse me a little, with all respect to everyone. The exception we're dealing with here is 1E, correct, which requires dangerous condition of a public facility, in this case, in a recreation area, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
We're not dealing with dangerous condition of a public building, 1C, correct?
No, we're not.
All right. So the issue is the only issued public facility as possible here, the zip line, or is something else bandied about as possibly the facility in this case?
We admit that we think the only waiver exception is the 1E public is this dangerous condition in a public facility.
I apologize. I think I'm not being clear. Okay. I suppose you could argue the zip line is a facility or it isn't. That's the question. You could also argue, I guess, the playground is a facility or maybe it isn't. I'm trying to figure what's the facility. What is the object or thing we're talking about as the facility? Is it only the zip line?
I think if you take the law and broadly construe the public facility term as you're supposed to, it is the zip line. But I think we're restricted to that. As I talked about in the brief, there's also the fact that if it was an integral part of the school itself, it would qualify as a public facility. It would actually qualify under 1C in that case, but as part of a public building.
That's why I asked, because all those cases about integral seem to me to deal with 1C, which I don't think was the issue here in this case. And that's, I think, why I got very confused. But so thank you for clarifying that. So let me ask, and then I'll shut up and let you continue to speak. Let's assume that the question before us is the court right in holding as a matter of law the zip line was not a public facility? That's the issue. What facts are out there that we would need to know? I mean, I guess the question is it really a question of law for us, or what are the facts that the court would have to hear on a hearing to decide if it was a public facility or not?
Just in terms of that, all we have is essentially a picture of the zip line that was contained in the responses to the motion to dismiss. I assume the court felt that there's no dispute over that that's the item that's not a public facility in its ruling. I think that's it. essentially then is you've got a zip line playground instrument that is in within a recreation area at a school. There is no, the court's right about this. There's no dispute about that part of things. It's contained in the recreation area of the school.
So for in front of us now, is that question a question of law, whether the zip line is a public facility? Or do you submit that there are fact issues that the district court should have considered?
With respect to just the public facility issue, yes, I believe this is a question of law. I don't think the relevant facts on regard to deciding that, I don't think are in dispute. I think the court was actually right on that.
Okay, thank you.
You referenced the statute itself, and the trial court did an interesting thing that I think is actually helpful from a different perspective, is it looked at it broke the waiver statute down into segments and went through each of them and talked about how 1A deals with the operation of motor vehicles and 1B deals with the operation of public hospitals, correctional facilities, and jails. And then got to 1C, and this is the important distinction to me that it didn't make, is 1C applies to the dangerous conditions in all public buildings. And if you compare 1C then to 1E, what happens is the court, one, ignores the distinction in the terminology. In 1C, you're using buildings as the term. In 1E, you're using facilities. So on one level, the legislature clearly intended a difference between the two by using facility instead of buildings. And more importantly, though, if you don't read facility to be something different than building, 1E is entirely superfluous. Because 1C takes care of dangerous conditions in all public buildings. If facilities isn't something different in 1E, what's the need for it? Because clearly if you have a building in a recreation area, it qualifies under 1C. You don't need 1E to get a building, a dangerous condition at a building. So
it would make no sense, because you would be then talking about a dangerous condition of a school in a rec area. I guess that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It would be the other way around.
But that's not my and I bring this up because my sense is that the mistake the trial court made is to try to think through this too hard and say that a piece of equipment in the recreation area isn't what I think a facility is. But I think the court was using facility as a term like a building when it did that.
Okay, so pardon me, counsel. Help us out that how you view that we can find as a matter of law, can conclude as a matter of law, that the zip line is a facility within the meaning of 1E.
Two parts. One is the definition of what a public facility is that's been contained in prior precedent from the Rosales case, where it simply says that it's something that is built or constructed to serve some public purpose. And I think clearly this is something that was built or constructed to serve some public service. From a factual standpoint, the two cases that I think provide the most help are first the Denmark v. State case I referenced in my brief, in which the discussion was about an athletic field in a recreation area. Now, I know defense counsel will say, well, they didn't address the public facility issue in that case. But by implication, I would say it's addressed because they allowed it to go on. But more important than that, where they actually address the facility issue, it's addressing 1D waiver, but the Anderson v. Highland Hills Park and Recreation District was addressing whether or not there was liability for a recreation district for a swimming, whether or not something constituted a swimming facility. And the Court of Appeals found that a screaming Mimi, whatever kind of ride that is, was actually a swimming facility. And that's where you get to me, if you're talking, we're getting down to the heart of this facility issue, but the screaming Mimi is a facility, a ride like the zip line, while I'm guessing smaller, should also be a facility under the public facility exception. I think that Anderson case is actually probably about as close as you get to the same factual scenario. And I think it's important because we're talking about the word facility in both instances. But I also referenced the statute the Gallegos case talks about from the Water Conservation Board and Compact, where it defines public facility in a very similar way to the way the Rosales has relied on that definition of a public facility in the ruling that it gave.
Counsel, I may be jumping far ahead of you, but I know that you want to reserve some time, so I'll get this question out now. Assuming that we were to reverse the trial court's dismissal of the action and send it back to the trial court, why then wouldn't a hearing be required on several of the other defenses that that the school district has raised, for example, the intervening cause?
I agree that if this is sent, that this, in fact, we're asking you to send back, and I anticipate that a hearing will be held on the four factors of determining whether or not this is a dangerous condition. I frankly expected that to happen in the first instance, because there's all sorts of facts in dispute over that, as you could tell from the briefing, about whether or not there was appropriate supervision, whether or not there was an intervening act. Those are things which there are contested facts. We've had quite literally no opportunity, given the nature of the way this comes before you, to do any discovery. Part of our responsive brief was to actually ask the court for some limited discovery to prepare for that hearing. I was going to address also that I think this negligent supervision issue plays is part and parcel with at least one of those factors. And the reason I think, and I just say briefly, that I think the negligent supervision claim should be reversed and survive because it's part of this fourth condition. We believe the zip line itself is dangerous, but the important fact matter here is that it was the inappropriate supervision of the zip line which made it even more dangerous, and in this instance we believe actually was a cause the incident to occur in which Lexi Loveland was injured.
Now, counsel, as I understand your negligent supervision argument, you're relying, and I'm cutting into your time, I apologize, but you're relying on cases that dealt specifically, they didn't deal with a negligent supervision claim per se, they were actually Governmental Immunity Act cases that where it survived. So why do those cases support you having a separate negligent supervision claim?
I see it as kind of like the same way premises liability is what's allowed to survive due to the waiver of immunity. I think the negligent supervision survives because of the same waiver clause. And what I would say is the negligent supervision cases that say that there isn't kind of a negligent supervision claim in school settings don't involve the dangerous there being a dangerous condition also. This case is specifically about a dangerous condition. The other cases are about supervision issues in which somebody was hurt by another kid or that kind of thing. The Douglas case that's cited by defense counsel actually specifically references the Hendricks case that we rely on and distinguishes it in an important saying. In distinguishing it from Hendricks, it says that unlike that case, which Douglas was some kid getting hurt with weightlifting equipment, the plaintiffs apparently hadn't alleged that there was some defective condition with the weights that played a role in that injury. And the court found that as a distinction between the Hendricks case, where apparently the unpadded wall was considered part of what created the dangerous condition. But Hendricks is our main case there. If I can, I got about a minute.
Counsel, you have 4 minutes. Appellee, you have 17 minutes.
Thank you.
And the bailiff should set the clocks accordingly.
May it please the court. My name is Gillian Falsing, attorney registration 33201, and I appear on behalf of the appellees, the St. Vrain Valley School District, and Kathy O'Donnell. I want to talk with you this afternoon about why we believe this appeal boils down to three questions. The first question, should the trial court have conducted a Trinity hearing? The second question,
what?
A Trinity hearing or an evidentiary hearing. The second question is whether or not the track ride, counsel has referred to it as a zip line, constitutes a public facility as is contemplated by 2410-1061E. And if so, we only get to the third question, which is, does the equipment also constitute a dangerous condition?
Ms. Fossing, before you get ahead of steam up, I was looking. I didn't see your name on anything. If you have not entered a formal appearance, could you file something at some point?
I have entered a formal appearance.
Okay. I didn't see it in what I had. I apologize.
I would respectfully submit to you that the answer to all three of these questions is no. In addition, there's simply no waiver of immunity for a negligent supervision claim. And it is for those reasons that this court should affirm the decision of the trial court. Now, first, talking about whether or not the court should have conducted a Trinity hearing or an evidentiary hearing. Looking at the Padilla case, the court's only required to conduct an evidentiary hearing when there is some evidentiary dispute as to the jurisdictional issues. And here, I would argue that that whether or not there's immunity or waiver of immunity is a matter of law, and therefore the trial court could rule on jurisdictional issues without a hearing.
So for our purposes of our analysis, we can assume there's a dangerous condition because it's a question of law?
No, I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. I would say that, let me tell you what I think the facts are that we can assume are undisputed, and those facts which particularly go to the jurisdiction issue versus other facts which wouldn't necessarily go to the jurisdictional issue. So the jurisdictional facts which are not in dispute are that the track ride is a piece of playground equipment located in a recreational area. So we don't dispute there's a recreational area. And indeed, that's in the record at page 54. You can see in that photograph that the track ride is in the playground area. It's not in any way attached to the school building. And it's also undisputed that the school is a public entity. And there are some other facts which are not disputed, which I don't know that they necessarily go to the jurisdictional issue, but for example, the type of equipment, the fact that the equipment was not defective, who installed the equipment, who manufactured the equipment, those facts are not in dispute. But what is
this? Counsel, let me interrupt you for just a second because I'm just not sure if I heard you correctly. Are you saying that this track ride was attached to the school building itself?
It was not.
No, it was not. Thank you. Sorry.
It was not.
And while I've got you, do you object to the characterization of it as a zip line, or is there some reason why you, counsel, are using
it? I think that that's just the correct name for the piece of equipment, and that's how it was authorized by the school.
All right, sorry, I don't mean to take your time right now.
Okay. So the issue here is whether or not the track ride can be considered a public facility located in a recreation area. And as Your Honor pointed out, I think that there's a very significant difference between a public facility and a public building. And the Hendricks case upon which counsel relies is not dispositive because the issue there was whether or not there was waiver under subsection 1C, whereas here the issue is whether or not there's waiver under 1E.
So what's a public facility? What is the definition of that?
Well, I think that the Rosales court goes and gives some good reasoning behind its reasoning that the tree was not considered a public facility. And that is, if you look at whether or not the facility provides a benefit or a use to the public. Now,
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm not sure. Maybe I didn't ask my question well. I'm just trying to figure out what is your definition of a public facility. And maybe we're getting there. But Rosales, the issue is the picnic area was the public facility in a park. And the question the court remanded on was whether the tree was in part of that picnic area. Okay. So what's the definition of public facility? That's the issue that's before us. And I didn't see, I'm not sure that you all defined that in your own brief.
Well, the issue here is whether or not the zip or the zip line or the track ride is a public facility. And what we're trying to ask this court to see is that it's not a facility. When we look at a public facility, we're looking at a sanitation district or a water facility or those other types of facilities as they're set forth in 106.1E.
You're agreeing it's public.
We do agree it's public.
Okay, it's the facility. You don't agree it's a facility.
Your Honor, I think that what we need to do here is look at the two words together and look at that in the backdrop of the legislative intent. And I think that had the legislature intended to include a piece of playground equipment as a public facility, it would have specifically listed that type of facility as it lists, you know, seven or eight other facilities within 106.1E.
But that goes against the doctrine of having to strictly construe any limitations on
Well, but I think here we need to look again at the overall purpose of the CGIA, which is, again, we can't, our schools and our teachers provide very, very valuable and essential service to the public. And
that's true, but it's in the CGIA is in derogation of the common law, and so we're required to strictly construe it, and we're supposed to expansively construe any waivers of liability, aren't we?
I agree with that, Your Honor, but I would also submit that in terms of construing statutes, the courts need to first look at the plain and ordinary meaning of the words.
Right. And that's why I was trying. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I still haven't heard an answer to my question. You've told me, I think, public facilities like a public hospital, like a public, I mean, I get that. And that, I think, is what Judge Tuttle was saying, you know, as she tried to say, whatever a zip line may be, it doesn't seem to fit in that category of the other things around it in 1A, and I get that. I still don't understand what you're saying, telling me. I'm looking for a definition. And then I looked it up, and, you know, my dictionary said, you know, just a regular dictionary, something built, installed, or established for a particular purpose, which is actually pretty close to the definition Mr. Thompson gave that came out of Rosales. Is that what a facility is? What? Tell me the definition of the word.
Well, I think I can tell you by looking at it in the negative, which is when we're looking at a facility, and I agree, in this case, we're not dealing with a building, but to construe a piece of playground equipment as a facility, I think strains the ordinary meaning of the word. I do. I think that what we're doing is we're trying to force some interpretation so as to, you know, allow this broad interpretation of public facility. And I don't think that that, from a statutory construction standpoint, is what was intended by the General Assembly.
Well, let's take Rosales. Built or constructed to serve a public purpose. Can't we say that of the track ride here?
Well, I don't think necessarily you can say that. And the reason for that is, you know, when we're looking at a public facility which operates for the benefit of the public, a playground at an elementary school, I wouldn't argue operates to the benefit of the public as a whole.
But does it have to operate as the public for the public as a whole? Can it operate for some subset? I mean, why do public schools have playgrounds if they're not for the children, at least, that are there? To use something that is built or constructed to serve some public purpose. Don't they serve some public purpose?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. But I think, again, that what we need to look at here is
I'll ask you this, counsel. It seems to me public can be two things. Either public access, that is, anybody can go to it anytime and use it, like is true of most playground equipment, say in a public park. The other means public ownership, public operation, some other connection with the public, other than just the general public can use it at their will. What does public mean in that dichotomy in this statute? Does it require that it be available to the public, or does it require some sort of public ownership or participation in operation? I don't want to limit it to ownership, but some public ownership or similar relationship?
I think I would argue the former, Your Honor.
Okay. So there's no question this is a public. This is public. It's owned by the public. It's operated by public. It's on public ground.
Yes, sir.
So the question is whether it's a facility.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
One point in your prior discussion, you said the public doesn't have access to it. And in most school grounds, they're open. I don't know what they are now. When I was growing up, they were open. They may not be all enclosed with chain link fences, but playgrounds are open for use year round.
I'm sorry, if that came across, Ron, that was not the intent that I had.
Okay.
I certainly didn't mean to say that if I did say that. Okay, then turning next to the Gallegos case, I think that that is very easy to distinguish in that the Gallegos case involves a very, very different statute, and that being 3760-126 subsection 1F, and that's contained within the Water Conservation Board and compacts. And I think the way that you distinguish those two statutes is that under the CGIA, specifically under subsection 1E, we're looking, well, there are two requirements. Number one, that there's a public facility, and number two, that it's located in a park or recreation area. Whereas in the other statute, the other statute includes park or other recreation area and what constitutes a public facility. So I think that the Gallegos case is not dispositive. And I wanted to address the Denmark case and the Anderson case, which Mr. Thompson brought up. And I would agree that the issue in the Denmark case was whether or not the field constituted a recreation area. And so that case is not dispositive to this case. And then with regard to the Anderson case, the issue was again whether or not this ride constituted a swimming facility. Again, that case is distinguishable because subsection 1E specifically references a swimming facility. But subsection 1E does not specifically reference playground equipment.
I think that's true, Ms. Falsing, but don't you say sort of this ride happens to be a swimming facility, and you were making the argument that you look at the context of 1E, and so you look at public hospital, jail, and these are the kinds of things that are a facility, kind of, I guess, by inference. All right. So if this kind of ride is a swimming facility, can't you make this, why doesn't that apply here in terms of, well, if that can be part of what's covered in 1E, on your argument, you're looking at the kinds of things that 1E covers. Well, we know 1E covers this kind of ride in a swimming pool. Why isn't a zip line a facility? That's very different, that ride in a swimming facility, than a hospital or a jail, seems to me.
Well, I believe that begs the question of why the legislature did not specifically include the language playground equipment or recreational equipment. I think if the legislature had intended that, it would have included that language within the statute. Right. In terms of the dangerous condition, I don't think that we even need to get to that argument because first we need to resolve the issue of whether or not we have a public facility. But I would note a couple of points there. As Judge Terry pointed out, we haven't addressed the issue of perhaps injury being caused by an intervening party. And, on the record at page 22, there is evidence that here Alexa's injury was indeed caused by another child and not by virtue of any physical condition of the track ride or zip line. There wasn't any allegation or any evidence before the court or anything in the record whatsoever which would suggest that there was a physical condition or a defective condition or anything about the mechanism in which Alexa was riding itself. Rather, I believe that Mr. Thompson's arguments really boil down to whether or not the school negligently supervised the children who were riding the track ride.
Ms. Olson, I can interrupt you briefly again, and I'm sorry for taking much of your time. Can we, let's assume just hypothetically, that we were to reverse on the issue of facility. Is it your position we can decide that other issues as a matter of law? You have very powerful arguments on these other issues, dangerous condition, and I understand them. Can we decide those as a matter of law without the district court having ruled on them or had a hearing?
In terms of the standard of review, Your Honor, I believe that this court can rule de novo. So if this court wants to rule as a matter of law, how it will interpret subsection 1E.
Let's say that we say we think a zip line is a the track ride, excuse me, was a facility. Can we then go on to say, but we find as a matter of law, it's not just not dangerous. It was not a dangerous condition on the record we have.
I think that if this court first answers the question, the legal question of whether or not it's a public facility, then this court can move forward to answer the third question of whether or not it's a dangerous condition. I believe that also constitutes a matter of law.
There isn't a question of mixed law, in fact?
Well, Your Honor, I think that that when we're looking at, under certain circumstances, I would agree with that, Your Honor.
I mean, in this particular instance, you've had at least two injuries this year or that year prior to this. Isn't that something that should be taken into account in determining whether this is a dangerous condition?
Well, I think that before you look at that notice issue, you need to look first at what the condition about which the injured party is complaining. And in this instance, there's no allegation that there was something about the physical condition of the zip ride or the track ride. And so I don't think
So it can't be shown that it's inherently dangerous for small children?
Well, Your Honor, I think that if the court found that it was something about the condition of the ride itself, the issue of whether or not there was notice, whether that's actual or constructive, could be addressed. But here,
let's talk about the condition. Are you suggesting that in order for there to be a dangerous condition for which the school district can be held liable, the equipment must have been defective or malfunctioned?
Well, I would submit that it has to do with something about the piece of equipment itself, and there's been no allegation here that there was anything wrong with the piece of equipment itself.
Oh, you say something wrong.
Well,
you meaning it malfunctioned or is defective, was defective, or couldn't it be inherently dangerous for small children and it shouldn't have been there in the first place?
I would disagree with all of those things, Your Honor. I think that in order for the school to have notice, there needs to be some identification of the problem with the equipment, whether it's defective in some way, whether it's there's something about the physical condition of the piece of equipment itself. And I don't think we can jump to say that it's inherently dangerous.
I'm not suggesting we can, but I mean there might be evidence to that that we don't have for children of this age or age group. Apparently it's been posted only to be used by the older children.
But the issue here is how Alexa was injured, and the only facts in the record indicating how she was injured are that another child pushed her. There's nothing in the record either that was alleged by the appellants in their complaint or in any of the subsequent briefing suggesting in any way that Alexa's injuries were caused by the equipment itself.
Don't take it, and I know your time's up and you're hanging in there great. Don't they get a chance to try to argue that and put on evidence of that? I understand your point. There's a lot of case law defines dangerous condition. And you say there's no evidence of nothing wrong with this ride, and so it's not a dangerous condition as a matter of law. I understand that's your point. I guess my question is, don't they get a chance to prove otherwise? They didn't get that chance. There was no evidence you're hearing.
I don't think they get that chance because whether or not the piece of equipment was a public facility is the first question that needs to be answered, and we answer that in the negative.
But you would agree, children pushing each other around during recess at school, that it comes no surprise to the school district.
I would agree with that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was really hoping to argue that point. I would deal with the dangerous condition, I think, for the most part, unless there's more questions about the public facility. I think the rule about broadly construing the term takes care of the legislative intent issue and why they didn't specifically name put the words playground equipment into the statute. But in case this court wants to go into the dangerous condition issue, once it rules that the court was an error on the public facility issue, I want to address some points there. And the fact is there are a lot of facts at issue on those for those questions. And the four-part test from Leuenberger, which we agree is the test for dangerous condition, right up front from whether or not Alexa was hurt as a result of a dangerous condition, or whether or not there was an intervening cause, as again provided as part of the exhibits we did in our response to the motion to dismiss, the manufacturer of this zip line had a big warning on it in pretty big letters that was installed with the with the zip line, you know, saying adult supervision required, given it was a school with elementary age kids, we think the particular way this accident hurt could have been stopped if there had been the kind of adult supervision we think the manufacturer envisioned for use of the product. And that's, at the very least, that's something we should be allowed to put on evidence on. Whether or not the zip line constituted an unreasonable risk to health would be getting into point two of that, the four-part test. We provided evidence that this, the zip line injury issue is more than just a couple kids that were hurt in the brief couple months, the beginning of the school year. It's been an issue in other school districts. We did it by just presenting articles, but the intent was if we were allowed to put forward evidence, we can is to bring somebody in to testify about those facts as well. And it was just to make it the court aware there would be a dispute, which we would be able to put on evidence of. And I'm not going to dive into all those things. I just want to note that's part of it, that we think that we have a strong argument that this zip line is actually inherently dangerous for the age kids that are in attendance at this school. Particularly for the waiver statute, it's important, though, that that danger is made worse if you're not doing the supervision that the manufacturer says you should be doing with the product. Part three, we think we clearly had evidence of, that's whether or not the danger was known to the defendants. Simply the fact that two other students had fallen and hurt themselves, we think, takes care of that. And the fact that the school had actually changed its policy after at least one of those kids had fallen to only allow fourth and fifth graders to use the zip line. If you're only allowing fourth and fifth graders to use it, that also kind of supposes somebody's going to be out there making sure only fourth and fifth graders are using it.
Grade was a plain event.
Fourth grade. Then the final part, which I started to talk about a little bit, and I think is actually where the heart of the matter will come, and if we're allowed to have a hearing on the issue, is whether or not something the defendants themselves did contributed to it. And it's kind of a two-part answer from our standpoint. One is the decision to put in what we think is an inherently dangerous product into the recreation area. But the second part, and I think almost more important, is this idea of the negligent supervision, is that they didn't provide the supervision that would have kept this incident from happening.
Can I ask for just to clarify that? On the negligent supervision, it seems to me you're arguing there are two separate points. One is that negligent supervision goes to the dangerous condition part, so it would fit within 1E on its own as it's relevant evidence, the negligent supervision. The other point is whether you can bring a claim for negligent supervision. And I mean, I understand the first, and I can at least theoretically see why it would be relevant evidence. I'm not quite sure what exception does negligent supervision fit under in the statute.
It may be more of an academic exercise, since it would be totally subsumed, I think, in the premises liability claim in a sense, but that's the idea, is that I think the claim for negligent supervision and the elements of it exist here, and immunity is waived because of 1E.
Again, I mean, and I know your time's up too, and I apologize. You have a separate claim for negligent supervision here, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, how does that fit into 1E? I mean, what in 1E gets us to say that's an exception? I understand why it may be relevant evidence to argue 1E, but I don't see how you get to bring a claim for negligent supervision.
I guess I see it as the same way 1E allows a premises liability claim to go forward. The negligent supervision claim is based in part on the dangerous condition waiver. I recognize if there wasn't a dangerous condition of a public facility, that there is no negligent supervision claim. So that's where it's the waiver of through the dangerous condition of a public facility that gets us, I think, the negligent supervision claim as well.
Thank you.
About a year ago, I visited the Australia courts, and they have unlimited argument. And it would appear that we are slowly working our way in that direction. I want to thank...
I love Australia.
I want to thank both counsel for their argument. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.